Hi, folks. Welcome back to Podcast Paroxysm. With me today, not Lee Jenkins, but someone close. It's close. It's Robbie Calland. Hey, Robbie.
Hey, Jordan. How yeah, no, doing? I'm not Lee Jenkins.
No, you're not.
Sadly.
I'm probably still going to tweet that it's Lee Jenkins just so people click on this.
That's fine with me.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Lee will be okay with it too.
Ah, Lee won't mind. He'll just think that you're like just you're bringing it back, like just tweeting it out one more time a week later.
Yeah, that's probably right.
That's normal. Yeah.
All right. So, let's get started. Let's just talk about, I mean, this entire weekend was incredibly exciting. There wasn't really a dull game, even though, you know, the Hawks game was mostly a blowout. Like, it was still interesting.
Was.
But
yeah,
let's start with the most exciting one.
Sorry.
Blazers, yeah. Rockets.
The nightcap.
Yeah. That was a hell of a nightcap.
I was so torn between needing sleep because I had work at 8 a.m. and had to be up at 6:30, and just wanting that game to go to, like, quintuple overtime. I was rooting so hard for, like, a tie game in that overtime period because it was so much fun. Like, I didn't care that everyone was fouling out. Like, I wanted it to get to the point where we just had bench players all on the floor, but just keep playing. It was incredible to watch. I mean, LaMarcus Aldridge had 46 or something ridiculous. I mean, LaMarcus Aldridge has 46. Dwight Howard looks like the Dwight Howard of old, despite whatever Shaq says. Damian Lillard, first playoff game ever, and he's out there being fourth quarter Damian Lillard that we know and love from the regular season. That for me was the best basketball game I've watched since Game 6 of the Finals last year.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but maybe it's because I'm not like thinking. But it was definitely one of the best games of this season.
For sure,
this season's been horrible, just in terms of like excitement.
Well, I mean, and that's why I don't feel bad saying that it's the best game since Game 6 of last year's Finals, considering that only encompasses Game 7 in this regular season. So
sure, that's fair.
Yeah, I'm not saying like of the last like 5 years or anything, but it was just an incredible game to watch. Aldridge, man,
he was terrific. And you know, it was interesting before there was an article about Aldridge. I think it was like 2 or 3 days before the playoffs. I think it was on the Oregonian. You know, he was saying, you know, I need to step up in a big way. Like, and you know, like we hear a lot of players say, like, you know, I got to step up. I have to be the leader of the team. But you know, Aldridge really did last night. He was unbelievable, and he was mixing it up inside and outside. He showed some really nice post moves. He had a few like up and unders, a few duck ins that just kind of made a fool of Terrence Jones. Even though like he still played well.
Well, that's the thing for me that I loved about what he did is whoever they threw on him, he took advantage of whatever mismatch he had. If he was on Dwight Howard, he took Dwight Howard out and faced him up. And, you know, played him away from the basket. And then when he had Terrence Jones on him, he was a back-to-the-basket player. You know, I love when guys do that. I love when guys show their versatility and use it to their advantage rather than kind of, you know, if you take Terrence Jones outside and just shoot jumpers and you're LaMarcus Aldridge, you're not utilizing your advantage to the fullest. And I loved watching him just play to the matchup and do whatever he had to do.
Right, and there were a few times, and I kind of wrote about this, where he was matched up with a lot of the smaller guys, like Francisco Garcia once or twice. And even like, and the great thing about Aldridge is he has two options there. Because he's such a good shooter from that mid-range and because he's so good at that turnaround, like he can shoot over him and he knows it's not going to get blocked anyways because the guy's so short and already it's a tough shot to block, or he can go into the post. So that right there, it's like it makes them even more dangerous because like it doesn't really matter who that matchup is at that point.
Yeah, I mean, he does such a good job of mixing it up and such a good job he knows his spots on the floor too.
Yeah,
you know, he knows his mid range spots. Every guy kind of has those spots on the floor where they feel most comfortable in, and he gets to those spots at will. He likes kind of that elbow jumper up by the free throw line, and he likes it on the baseline a little bit, but he doesn't stray too much to the middle of the floor or into these areas where he's not comfortable. You pretty much see him shoot from the same areas because he knows what he wants to do. And he's got the wherewithal to get to those places too and not get shoved off his spot. That was the other thing. You know, Dwight Howard, part of what makes Dwight Howard really good is he gets guys off of their spot. And he wasn't really, when he was, in the few times he was on Aldridge, he wasn't really able to do that.
Right, right. Which, I mean, that was really interesting to see that too, because Dwight's been so good defensively. And like you said, he's so good at forcing those guys out. And Aldridge, like, he's strong, but he doesn't, like, strike you as, like a Pekovic type guy who you're not going to move.
Mm-hmm.
But still, like, he didn't move him.
But
let's talk about Houston for a little bit. They have that 13-point lead pretty late into the fourth, and it just kind of goes away. I mean, a lot of it has to do with Aldridge being 7 of 8 from the field in the fourth quarter, and then, you know, Lillard knocking down that great shot to tie the game, and then Aldridge also tying the game later after that. But what do you make of Houston's late game or lack thereof offense?
It's hideous. It's pretty much just hoping and praying that James Harden can either make a ridiculous shot or get himself to the foul line. And it's been a problem all year. I mean, this isn't something new that nobody's written about. I think for Houston, they've got to figure something out. You know, that when they came out in the overtime period, that when they went on that quick little 6-0 run, they did a good job with the pick and roll. Jeremy Lin got himself into the lane, made a floater, made a layup, got himself to the free throw line. And it wasn't just James Harden pounding the ball into the floor. And that final possession was just, I honestly don't know what Harden was doing. He gets bottled up and gets kind of trapped at the elbow, picks the ball up, and rather than passing it out, just kind of stands around, pivots for a minute, and then turns around and fires something up. It was just kind of, that possession was almost the worst possible scenario for them, because it just kind of was a culmination of everything they've struggled with in late game situations coming to pass, especially with Dwight Howard not being there kind of as a bailout in the post.
Right. It was just weird, like that last possession especially. You'd think that Harden would recognize that he doesn't have a good shot there. They'd try, I mean, give credit to the Blazers, they did get him out of his comfort zone. They made him pick up his dribble sooner than he would have liked. But it was still, like, that was just bad offense.
That's horrible.
And then before we move on, we should probably talk about Howard fouling out, because the NBA just released a statement saying that the foul should have been on Joel Freeland and Howard should have had two free throws. Haka Howard had already been fairly successful up to that point. Do you think that makes a difference?
Well, I think it makes a difference for a couple reasons. One, up to that point, you know, Haka Howard had worked earlier, but he was, I think, 6 for his last 7 free throws heading into that point, over the overtime period and the last 2 free throws he took before the end of the game or regulation. And, you know, I don't know whether he makes them or not, but I also think, you know, what I mentioned where he can be kind of that safety outlet in the post for Harden there, or maybe the threat of having him in the pick and roll forces Portland maybe not to double quite as hard as they did on Harden. You know, you heard in the post game interview, Damian Lillard said that their entire goal was just to double Harden hard. They knew they were going to him. But that decision to double hard, especially if you're the big man, becomes so much harder when you know Dwight Howard's rolling to the rim and all it takes is a lob to tie it.
No, yeah, I completely agree. It's interesting that the NBA is doing this for the big decisive calls, not for every call. And I'm sure there's going to be something up on Paroxysm soon about this. but, you know, the officiating last night, like, both ways was shoddy. Was shoddy, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a Bennett Salvatore fan in any way, shape, or form. So I'll just say that was a vintage Bennett game. You know, that is just a lot of it. See, and you know, it's interesting. We've seen that in a few games of this series, and I wonder, especially going Let's go ahead and shift gears and talk a little Clippers Warriors, if you don't mind.
Okay.
And, you know, we saw Blake Griffin foul out. We saw Andre Iguodala foul out. Both of them played less than 20 minutes in their foul outs.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I think, to an extent, I think it was the refs trying to take control of the series early. Coming into that series, we knew there was bad blood. We knew those two teams didn't like each other, and everybody was talking about, oh, you know, we're going to get technical fouls, we're going to get flagrants. And my thought, and this wasn't something I had immediately, but as I've thought about it, is the refs were like, okay, we're just going to lay down the law early. We're not letting this get out of hand. We're not letting this contact get to the point where we're going to have fights. Because everybody's been talking about, oh, when are we going to get kind of a scuffle in this series between these two teams? And I think that was the ref saying, that's not happening. And for better or worse, that's what they did, and we saw what it did. It took, you know, Blake Griffin completely out of the game and Andre Iguodala out of the game. And so, do you think that's kind of was the MO of that? It looked, because they were calling everything, anything where there was any contact.
I think it was a mix of both. I think it was that they wanted to get, you know, the series under control. The refs wanted to put their kind of foot down, be like, look, we're not going to have Matt Barnes going to, you know, pretend and choke somebody like in this series. Like, no, that's not happening. But at the same time, I also think that's just kind of how the playoffs are, especially game one. And I have no data to back this up, so this could just be a hot take.
Heat, bring it.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I just think that's, like, game one of the playoffs is always an adjustment for everybody involved. Sure. So I wouldn't be surprised if that factored into it as well. And also, sure, it could just be, like, that's the officiating crew. Like, you know, we see games officiated differently based on the crew. Sure. So I don't know.
Aren't they trying to keep the crews together more this year?
Yeah,
I think... Wasn't that in that release that they sent out before the end of the regular season? They want to keep kind of a continuity of crews, and I'm interested to see how that pans out.
Oh, no, then Houston, Portland's going to be miserable.
Oy. Because that's, isn't it, it's Bennett, Scott Foster, I think, is on there. That's going to be a rough one.
Anyways, we should probably switch to, I can just let you go on this one, Eastern Conference, the Hawks.
They won a basketball game.
They did win a basketball game. That was surprising. Exactly. If it had been like a 1 or 2 point win, like, okay, this would be fun. But no.
No. And it was, I mean, I think, what is it, 101-93? And it was not even
It was not that close. Indiana went on a nice run, like encouraging run towards the end. But,
yeah. It was everything, you know, and the thing is the Hawks executed defensively as well as they can. It was thoroughly impressive watching them. They were hard trapping off pick and rolls. They forced Paul George to pick up his dribble, or they forced him into tough shots off the dribble. They didn't really let him get to the paint. And they essentially said, listen, if you want to throw it to a rolling Roy Hibbert and have him try to shoot over a help defender, so be it.
Yeah.
That's fine. They said, if Roy Hibbert's going to beat us offensively, Roy Hibbert beats us offensively, and there's nothing you can do about it. But as long as we can keep our starters out there, Paul George and, to be honest, Lance had that run in the second quarter when I think he was guarded by Cartier Martin and or Shelvin Mack, who I love what Cartier can bring to the offense sometimes. And I say sometimes. But defensively, Cartier's a warm body out there, essentially. And he's big, and we need wings in Atlanta. And if you're looking at – and then Shelvin Mack's just too small for Lance – you know, Lance came back and down. Him and Lou Williams are just too small. But Lance didn't do a ton against Kyle Korver, who Kyle Korver had two help side blocks on Roy Hibbert.
And they weren't like weak blocks, like where you like barely. No. They were emphatic.
Clean, emphatic. One of them sent it out of bounds. It was. I was sitting by myself in my living room, screaming profanities in excitement on both of his blocks, and the world got to see the wondrous play of Pero Antic.
Is that how it is? It's Antic.
It's Antic. Yes.
Okay.
For those that don't know, Pero Antic, my boy, he was out there. You know, he sprayed a couple of threes in, and him being out there is such a nightmare for Roy Hibbert. Because Indiana essentially has to decide, do you put Roy Hibbert on Pero, who essentially just posts outside the 3-point line? Like,
yep.
He lives out there. That's his job, and he's good. He shoots 35% or something from three. 34%. He's very much a threat from out there. Or do you put him on Paul Millsap, who, again, can shoot the three, but will also just get the ball in the mid-range and face up Roy Hibbert and go by him. So Indiana's got some really tough decisions, and it just compounds their issues that they have. You know, they clearly have chemistry issues going on. And I kind of want to talk about this.
Some selfish dudes
here. Roy Hibbert took it three.
Yeah.
That got lost in everything. That's gotten lost. Roy Hibbert, and it wasn't a desperation three. He spotted up in the corner, and I think somebody, whoever threw that pass, probably did it on accident, thinking, okay, somebody's open in the corner, and then they saw Roy after they let it go, and were like, oh, crap.
Yeah, and then also, I think that's one of the defining moments of game one, and it could be one of the defining moments of this series. Not because he took the three, but just that he took the three, and like that's what this has come to. But then also Paul George holding the ball at the top of the arc, and just like shrugging his shoulders, holding his hand out, and just wondering what the heck to do. And then David West down low in that corner doing the same thing, like yelling at each other, like, oh, this is bad.
Didn't Steve wrote about a play today, Steve McPherson, in the Grantland shootaround, where George Hill was like stood at the top and nobody did anything, so he just kind of drove it into three guys and DeMar got a steal.
Yeah, right.
It's really brutal to watch, and I kind of want to do this. I don't want to give too much of a hot take here, because I really do kind of believe this, but trading Granger has clearly had an impact on the chemistry of this team.
No, I think it has. I think that's fair to say. To the extent, like, we don't know, it's the extent.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, anytime you take away a guy like that, a guy who was a leader, a guy who was really well-liked in the locker room, and a guy who had meant a lot to the franchise before that,
and then he was.
And you bring in, you know, Evan Turner, and let us not forget Andrew Bynum.
The great one. I think Bynum taught Hibbert that little 3-point shtick.
He probably did.
He was like, listen, they'll just throw it to you once because they won't be expecting it. He's like, I used to do this in LA all the time. It was hilarious. Because, you know, Bynum would get that random three in LA, and you knew it was because the guys weren't expecting him to be up there, so they just accidentally threw him a pass. But I think the thing about it is, you look at it this way, that team has been together for a little while, but outside of David West, there's not a lot of veterans on the team. Roy Hibbert is definitely not what you would call a leader kind of guy, you know? I mean, he's a good defensive anchor, but he's not a vocal guy that in the locker room. And, you know, you have David West, who's a strong voice, but David West has also been known to kind of get frustrated with guys, you know?
Yeah.
David West is kind of the brimstone guy. Danny Granger was the calming influence, I think, in that locker room that features a lot of volatile guys. You have West, you have Lance Stephenson, you have Paul George, who can get fiery. And I think Granger was a calming influence on all those guys. He was Paul George's mentor. I think Lance Stephenson kind of trusted him. And I think you need multiple voices in the locker room. And to an extent, I think now who is the voice outside of David West who's who has a very, you know, unique style of motivation, which is more of just yelling at guys and being very kind of intense. You kind of need that calming influence. You know, I think for the Hawks, that calming influence is Elton Brand. As I've seen, Elton Brand and Kyle Korver are kind of that guy, the calming influence, the nice guy. And Paul Millsap's more of the fiery guy in the huddle.
Right.
Which is surprising when you talk to Paul because he's very mild-mannered in interviews.
I also think it's that you were saying you had Lance. Well, they had Lance last year, but it's also Lance now plays a bigger role, and Lance has had a taste of success.
Sure.
And so, it's keeping those guys in line, keeping them with level heads, and so it's
egos in check because Lance is trying to get that money. Lance needs that's free agent money he's looking at, and you cannot tell me that does not play a role in the guy's head when he knows he's a free agent this summer.
Right.
It always does, and if you're in a place where, and you have the ball a lot, it's hard not to be thinking, okay. And I'm not saying on the court he's like, okay, I can get my money, but just in general, he's like, maybe he's thinking, maybe I need to be more aggressive at kind of trying to score and trying to be me. And that's an interesting group. But let us not forget that Jeff Teague was marvelous.
He did. Played really well. We get more playoff Teague.
Mm. And the funny thing is, we haven't seen vintage, I guess, playoff Teague since that Chicago series. He was actually quite mediocre last year against Indiana. I thought George Hill actually outplayed him, which he certainly is not this year.
Right.
And through the first game, he was torching George Hill. I loved it. I love when Jeff gets aggressive and goes downhill, and he was just and that's the thing, and that comes from having that spacing. I think that's when you can force them, they love to sag under pick and rolls and kind of, they don't mind a mid-range jumper here and there, but when your bigs are making threes, they have to think about getting out on that three-pointer because it's just you can't be giving those up. And so I think, if you watch them, they're a little, David West, Roy Hibbert, they're kind of stepping out a little higher on the pick and roll, and T can get by him, and he's getting to the rim, and he's getting to the foul line, and it's going to be interesting to see. I've seen a lot of reports that Paul George is going to pick up Teague defensively, and I'm interested to see how that turns out.
Hmm. That'll be interesting. Yeah, I think I like that matchup. I think I don't know if I like it full time, but I think to start off to kind of just disrupt the Hawks' rhythm, that'll be
a different look. Now, the one thing that does create is it puts George Hill or probably George Hill on Kyle Korver. And guarding Kyle Korver is no easy task, and it's going to be interesting to see if George Hill has the patience and the focus to just chase Kyle around screens all day, because that is a miserable afternoon,
right,
evening on the basketball court chasing Kyle Korver. I would not want to do that. It just seems miserable to do, because he just runs all day.
You know who else runs all day?
Who does?
Russell Westbrook.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That first half. Holy cow.
It was a bloodbath.
Memphis.
They could not score.
Was shell-shocked. They came out. What was it? They were down, 11-0 after, 3 minutes?
Yeah. And then they ended up being down 20-something, overall. It was bad. It was horrible.
It was so bad. I actually went outside and just kind of sat on my porch and hung out until about I felt bad watching it. I needed a little breather from basketball because I've been watching since 12:30 that afternoon.
Right.
And I just kind of went out and sat on the porch and had a cigar and kind of decompressed a little bit before I came back in for the end of the third quarter and the fourth quarter when the Grizz kind of started figuring some of it out. And it was interesting kind of how the Grizz figured it out. They just played the same lineup.
Well, they played the same lineup, but like
20 straight minutes.
Their defense came, finally woke up. They played a lot better. That's one thing. They were missing a lot of shots. They could not hit anything from outside. They went through that enormous stretch to start the game where everything came inside. They could not hit an outside shot. The first person to hit an outside shot was Tony Allen. which, you know, should tell you something.
It definitely does something. And it's going to be, and I think for Memphis, that's been the fear for the last, what, few years?
Yeah. They need more outside shooting. And, you know,
yeah.
Tayshaun Prince isn't going to give that to you.
No.
Courtney Lee's done a good job when he came in here. But, you know, if you're relying on Courtney Lee and Mike Miller to really be your main perimeter guys, like, that's a good plan. I just don't, you know, they still need that one more feature perimeter guy.
Sure. And you know, I know that they'll be looking for it. And I know that it's something that I'm sure the Grizzlies, knowing John Hollinger, from
name drop.
Knowing Hollinger from his time here in Atlanta, when he was based out of here for ESPN, I know Hollinger wants that. I talked to him at Summer League, and he was excited about Mike Miller. You know, I mean, and Mike Miller's been solid for them. He's definitely helped them in that regard. But it's so tough to find that guy, and make it worthwhile. Shooters. They're kind of funny in the way that their effectiveness is definitely based off of how you're getting them looks. Not all three-point shots are created equal, and Memphis has to find a guy who can fit what they do, which is more of an inside-out style. And, because you see guys that people expect to be good three-point shooters, and they go somewhere, and all of a sudden they're not. So it's going to be interesting to see how Memphis tries to remedy this, considering they're such a slower paced team. It's harder to create open looks when you don't move the ball as quickly.
Yeah. I mean, Jaeger, to start the year, said like that's what he wanted to do, is to get into his sets faster, and he wanted to move the ball faster, not necessarily like up the tempo, although he tried that at first and that was a disaster.
Well, I'm going to give you real quick. I talked to Elton Brand about that at the beginning of the year. I was like, you know, what's it, you know, coming in the year, obviously Coach Bud wants to push the pace, and he goes, everybody wants to run in training camp. Everybody wants to push the pace in training camp. He's like, it's hard to do that in February and March and April.
Yeah.
And it's true. I mean, every year, every team says we want to play with more pace. And for the most part, teams are. I think, was it Haberstroh that had a piece on that a couple weeks ago, how like 28 teams are playing faster this year? But to the extent that they say they want to, it's just hard, especially when you have a team built around two big guys like Zebo and Marc Gasol.
Yeah, it is. And then, you know, that they fixed that issue early on in terms of like, no, okay, maybe we should go back to slowing it down.
Yeah.
But KD was
marvelous.
He was marvelous. He was incredible. That, you know, I kind of wrote this for the 10, the thing that we're doing on ESPN, where at this point, nothing should really surprise us in terms of what KD does. But every single game, he finds like that one way to just stun us, to be amazing. And yeah. that pass that he just reached out improbably and snagged and hit the layup without dribbling, he was basically underneath the rim. Oh, it was tremendous.
I watched that gif probably 50 times and still have no idea how he did it. He caught it off his fingertips like he was – and, like, caught it and immediately had control. Like, it wasn't one of those where he, like, tipped it and kind of bobbled it. Caught it with one hand like he was, like, Randy Moss. And then off the wrong foot, off his right foot, lays it up with his right hand without ever touching the ball with his left. And he was, like, almost under the basket. I'm still baffled by that one. And then Westbrook was Westbrook.
He was Westbrook, both, you know, good and bad.
And you let Westbrook beat Westbrook. And he was – yeah, I mean he was – there were some rough patches in the second half when the Grizz were on that comeback trail. But, they kind of figured it out. And
you know who else was really impressive? Steven Adams.
Yeah.
He came in. He's been pretty good on defense this year for them. But he came in. He had, I think it was, what, like three, four blocks in a pretty short – not just held his own. He played really well. It's funny, I remember in the thread before the season began, you know, we were talking about, no, I think Steven Adams is actually going to have an impact this year. And we were all like making fun of each other for saying that. Like, this is how we know it's preseason and like how there's no NBA, because we're thinking Steven Adams is actually going to make an impact on a championship contender. And right. Now Steven Adams is making an impact
on the championship contender. Well, and then there was the third quarter of Perkins. That was, my goodness. He was, I mean, that was vintage Perk as a throwback.
Yeah.
To the Kendrick Perkins that carried my WAC fantasy team for like 13 weeks of the season. I was so bummed when he got hurt, because like he got hurt 2 weeks before our like playoff started. I ended up losing in the championship round because Perk wasn't back to his normal minutes. I was so bummed.
Blame Scott Brooks.
I do blame Scott Brooks.
So let's switch gears again.
Back to the East?
Yeah, we can go back to the East.
Go back to the East.
Talk some Bulls and Wizards.
That game was surprisingly fun.
Yeah.
For a Bulls game. Now, I expect the Wizards. I expect the Wizards to be fun. And yes, and Bulls fans, you know your team isn't fun.
It's funny. I expect the Bulls to be fun. Well, I don't know. I don't always expect them to be fun. But when they are fun, it's in spite of Tom Thibodeau, because he doesn't make them fun. And the Wizards, I expect them to be fun and good in spite of Randy Whitman. So it's perfect.
Right. Yeah, it's fun. And Beal and Wall were not good.
No, they weren't. It was Nene.
Oh my goodness. Nene was, he's incredible. He and the Polish Hammer, Gortat, was down there just, you know, it's funny. You look at the matchups and you initially would think, okay, well, Noah and Taj are going to be able to at least contain Nene and Gortat. Mm-hmm. Like, you're like their problem is going to come with Kirk Heinrich trying to defend John Wall's feet. Like, that's what I thought the problem would be.
Wrong. Right. Wrong. And then we were wrong. We were all wrong.
Way wrong. I look at it this way. You know, you think about how much Joakim Noah helps on the perimeter and helps with that perimeter defense. And I think, I haven't looked at the film to really look at this, but this was just a theory I was working on this morning while I was trying not to focus on doing actual work.
Right. Sure.
As I do. And it was that, you know, Joakim, maybe he had one eye on John Wall a lot of the game, and he's thinking, okay, we can't let John Wall beat us. We can't let him get to the rim. We can't let him do this. And Wall was just – he did a good job facilitating and getting it to Nene and getting it to Gortat. And when you have one eye on the point guard, maybe you're a step slower and you're not getting the guys off the spots the way – you know, we talked about how Dwight normally gets guys off of their spots. Joakim does that better than anybody. You know, yeah. Joakim works so hard early. He puts so much work in early in defending that it makes it easier on himself once the ball actually gets to a guy. And I think maybe and you know, again, this is just kind of a thought I had, is maybe Joakim is – his concern is with Wall a little more, so maybe Nene is able to get into his spot a little better. Maybe Gortat's able to get to his spot a little better, and they're getting them the ball in better scoring areas than you normally would against the Bulls' front line.
Yeah, and this is what's going to be interesting, is Thibodeau's so great at adjustments.
Yep.
And Randy Whitman is Randy Whitman. And so I don't expect game two to go similarly. Like, I expect John Wall to play a lot better. I expect Bradley Beal to play a lot better. I don't expect Gortat and Nene to dominate like they did.
No. And I think that might be one of the adjustments is Thib says, okay, you know, you want to keep Wall and you want to keep Beal in front of you, but let's make sure that we're not letting Nene catch it deep you know, he got a few post looks right by the hoop. Let's make sure Gortat can't catch it rolling directly to the hoop. Let's jam him on the roll. Whereas they seem to be trapping high and hedging hard, and so it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see how Thibs makes those adjustments, because I think Game 2 is going to have a very different look to it, and maybe the Wizards can still capitalize. Wizards have a lot of weapons.
They also have Randy Whitman.
The equalizer, the great equalizer, Randy Whitman. It's funny. Most times we think of coaches as maybe the equalizer in one way, but no, Randy Whitman equalizes the other way.
The other way.
Let's get to you want to get to some Brooklyn, the hate fest?
We can get to that. I was either going to go to that or to Spurs Mavericks. We can go to whatever.
Let's go Spurs Mavs.
Let's go Spurs Mavericks. And before we talk about anything else, that Craig Sager Jr. Popovich moment,
incredible.
It was incredible. It was terrific. It was heartwarming. I've rewatched it a lot, and the thing that really gets me it's this one moment. It's not necessarily what Pop said, even though what he said was, you know, it was rehearsed. It was heartfelt. It was great. It was when he turns to the camera. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why it struck me so much, but it's, you know, it's, he's breaking the fourth wall between spectator and participant. And he's mm-hmm. like, yeah, the entire audience is watching it, but he's only speaking to Craig Sager. And you know, it show, you know, Pop ranges anywhere from curmudgeon to prickly, mm-hmm. in those interviews. He obviously hates those sideline interviews, but it shows just what immense respect he has for Craig Sager. That was an absolutely touching moment. It was lovely. It was great.
Absolutely. I used to actually write with Craig Sager Jr. I know Craig Jr. And so to see that, and it meant a lot. I've met Craig Sager Sr. you know, a few times, obviously in Atlanta. He's around. He's from here. And knowing Craig Jr., it was touching. It really was, and I was really happy that Pop did that and that he insisted on doing that live. I know they thought about taping a segment before the game, and Pop said no.
Yeah, that was cool.
This is important.
Moment was terrific.
It was almost as if Pop was saying, "Look, this is more important than basketball." You know, to tape a segment before and just to plug it in, Pop's like, no, I can take 30 seconds aside from this basketball game. I can take a minute to really, you know, say something that needs to be said. And everything, all the Craig Sager tributes, all the TNT guys in the studio.
Wearing the socks.
Wearing the suits. Yeah, wearing the Sager suits. And yeah. Steve Kerr with his Sager suit and all of that. Benny the Bull, that was fantastic. That was definitely something that probably one of the highlights of playoff weekend was the support for Craig Sager, who we all kind of, you know, he comes off a bit clownish because of his wardrobe, but he really is the best in the business at what he does. He always has good questions, and he really knows the game and he knows what he's doing.
Here's my thought on Sager, and just real quick, we'll go back to the actual game.
Sure.
But you know, his suits, they're outlandish, but I almost think they're a bit of a camouflage. Mm-hmm. Like it disarms you a little bit. Like, oh, well, you know, who can this guy be with these, you know, clownish outfits? But the questions he asks are terrific and they're very pointed. He was here in Denver. I forgot who they were playing. It was on TNT, so obviously he was there.
Right.
And he went in on Brian Shaw, asking him, like, grilling him about the whole Andre Miller debacle. And he told Shaw it was coming. He told him before, like,
sure,
the pre-impressor, but still, like, to see a guy go in on that. And you don't really see that from most reporters nowadays. And, like, he went in there and Shaw didn't get defensive. Like, he answered the questions. I think it's, one, because Sager told him it was going to happen. But, two, it's also because of the respect these guys have for him.
Absolutely. I mean, I think... you know, he and David Aldridge are the two that, and Doris Burke, when she does sideline stuff, that they ask very pointed questions. They ask basketball questions. They avoid the vague tropes of what did you see in the first half? What did you see in the they ask pointed questions. They know the game, and I think it's those coach interviews and the little in the huddle moments are usually very vague.
Neutered.
And very it's just kind of like, oh look, we have this access, but you're not really getting anything. And I think those three, Sager and Burke and Aldridge, do as good a job as any of actually making it somewhat worthwhile to watch.
Yeah.
And so it's been said a bunch over the weekend, but we also hope Sager has a speedy recovery and full recovery from his battle with leukemia.
Yep. Yeah. But so now back to the actual game.
Basketball.
Do you know why I could never be a coach? Because this, like, the second that I see
they don't allow you to do Photoshops.
Well, there's that. Which, come on, okay. Like, how else am I supposed to illustrate? Like, you guys go here. Look at this. Look at this lovely Photoshop. Look at El Cabongo. He will tell you what to do.
Here's your general manager, Carrot Mori.
Here's Carrot Mori.
Anyway,
it's because if my team got down 10 in the fourth quarter, like the Spurs did, I'd panic. I'm just like, nope, sorry, game over. We're done. We're screwed. Like, I blew this one. Like, there's no coming back from this. It's 10 points. Who can come back from 10 points? And then the Spurs, as they're wont, they get all methodical and with their lethal precision, just out-execute the Mavs down the stretch. Tim Duncan was phenomenal.
Dallas didn't score in the last seven minutes. No field goals in the last 7 minutes. That is ridiculous. And it's amazing. It almost, they bookended it. You look at the first quarter, Dallas couldn't score. Then the Spurs almost felt like they let up, tried to figure things out the way Pop does. Tinkered with some lineups. I think Tony Parker didn't shoot in the third quarter after dominating the first. He tried to get Duncan active and do some things. And I think after the game, Parker said, oh, we just wanted to get Duncan comfortable. And it's like, how confident can you be to just say, let's get this guy comfortable. Let's get him going. We can sacrifice some offense just to get this guy going because we know we'll need him.
Yeah.
It's awesome. I mean, it's awesome that they can do that.
Also, Devin Harris was a thing for a little bit.
Devin Harris was one of my favorite guys to cover last year when he was here in Atlanta. And I'm so happy that he's healthy and was a thing for like 10 minutes of that game.
Didn't he have like 13 points?
Yeah, he was fun. He made.
He was good. He was Devin Harris.
He was the only one that could stay in front of Tony Parker.
Right. Right. Four I remember Calder like camp. All those years ago when just after Devin Harris got traded, Tony Parker was like, I'm glad he got traded. Now I don't have to be guarded by him, and I don't have to guard him because it's impossible to do that.
Devin Harris is pesky, man.
Yeah, he is. And he was also like really fast.
Oh yeah, and like it's funny, he's kind of slowed down, but he still is one of those guys that he is so good at changing speeds. I equate it to kind of like a pitcher. He's got his fastball slowed down, but he's honed in on his changeup. He knows how to kind of slow down and then jump on you. He kind of pedals it down when he's dribbling, and then he attacks the rim with a quick burst. He still has that burst and gets by people. And he still has the confidence to just kind of pull up and make those three-pointers. And sometimes he takes some ones you don't want. But do you think Dallas should be at least relatively confident because they lost so close and because Monte and Dirk played pretty bad on the offensive end? Or do you think it's just like that was their chance, they blew it?
I think it might have been the latter. I think because both Popovich and Carlisle are terrific tacticians. Mm-hmm. And so to see, I think Popovich will go back and see in the tape what was working for Dallas and then how he can negate that. Carlisle obviously do the same, but I think this series will still be competitive for at least one or two more games. But then I just think the Spurs keep executing, keep being the Spurs. Yeah, I don't.
They're the Spurs.
Yeah, the Spurs. Like, I just think it's cute that Dallas is in the playoffs. I'd still much rather Phoenix, San Antonio, so I could have playoff Dragic.
Well, that's you're selfish.
I don't think I'm selfish.
No,
I'm a little selfish. I'm
a little selfish. No, not.
All right, so let's go up. Let's go up north.
Yes.
Masai Ujiri is the man.
Masai Ujiri, hero. Hero. I had the pleasure of writing about this for today's super overreactionizer that we did on Fansided. It was super fun to write and just bring heat, straight hot takes.
White hot heat.
Like, I just shut the brain off and let it flow. It was beautiful. And you should read them. They're all terrific. It's up on the Fansided main page. Fansided main page. Last I checked. And but it was really funny. Toronto seems so fired up to play Brooklyn. And Brooklyn is kind of like these old dudes that are like, eh. Like, we're just going to play. We're going to, you know, Paul Pierce is Paul Pierce, so he kind of gets himself fired up. And KG, but like, Joe Johnson, I don't think Joe knows he's playing Toronto. He's just kind of out there doing what Joe does.
Do you think, like, at this point, like, Joe just, like, he kind of exists in his own universe? Like, he sees everything else is just like a black, just like a, I don't know, like everything else is black to him except for his teammates.
Joe's been doing that since 2010.
Right, okay, so like everything else, like nothing else exists to him. And so he's just kind of like going through the motions. Like, it's in a good way, but it's like, hey, Joe, did you watch the tape? It's like, tape of who? You know, the playoffs are starting. Yeah, I know, this doesn't, you know, it's going to go out.
I think Joe just shows up, like, they just take him on road trip. If nobody tells Joe that the season ends, I think he just keeps showing up to the arena every day.
He just, like, he relives the schedule in the summer and just, like, keeps going.
It's Groundhog Day. Joe Johnson starring in Groundhog Day. He just wakes up every morning and goes to the arena. Some mornings that happens to be an arena on the road. Who knows? And he just kind of goes and he does Joe Johnson things. He does that little sideways dribble into the lane. And then, like, I've been astounded by that at that move since he came to Atlanta. I'm gonna talk my way through it. He comes up off the wing, and he somehow gets himself slowly inching closer to the basket. And then once he gets about 10 feet from the hoop, he just starts going sideways like a crab. Like, and I've never understood how people don't steal the ball, because he's still dribbling it like away from his body, and he just kind of sideways dribbles into the lane, and then just does a little push floater. Like, without running, he just kind of pushes the ball one-handed at the rim. And I think the dude shoots, like, 55% on him. I don't actually have numbers to prove that.
Well, who needs numbers? Just watch the game.
It feels like that. I watch the games, okay? I've been watching Joe do this forever. Damn it. I know what I'm talking about. And he did it all game. He just uses his girth, that God-given booty, and backs his way in on smaller defenders like poor Terrence Ross, who had no chance. Terrence Ross did not know what to do when Joe started backing him down.
No, he's like, well, what's happening?
He's like, wait a minute. This guy, Joe Johnson, is massive. For people that don't understand, this guy plays two guard, and he is like 6'8", 260.
That's a big boy.
He is almost the same size as LeBron James. He just doesn't run. Joe just doesn't know how to run. He just kind of walks everywhere and backs his way into places. He is huge. So, like, I don't blame Terrence Ross for not knowing how to defend a guy backing you down from 20 feet, which is what Joe does. He just starts backing you down from, like, the three-point line, and all of a sudden he's 7 feet from the rim and throws up a hook. He did that, like, 3 times. And then fourth quarter Paul Pierce. I'll let you talk about fourth quarter Paul Pierce. I did my piece about Joe.
Paul Pierce traveled.
A lot.
A lot.
A lot. He always has, though.
Yeah, but there was one there, like, blatant. But anyways, look, he was good in the fourth quarter, and I hate... Although I hate that somehow validates his putrid, like, first three quarters.
Hey, veteran experience, baby. It's all about the fourth quarter.
Count the rings. Take that, Masai Ujiri.
Take that. Second round picks be damned.
Right. I'd much rather talk about Toronto, though, because...
You want to talk about Toronto?
I do want to talk about Toronto, because it's interesting. That atmosphere before the game was awesome to see.
Turned up. Absolutely turned.
The banner. Masai Ujiri.
Dropping F-bombs.
Dropping F-bombs.
That's a legendary video.
It's really cool to see, like, the city really embracing the team because, like, you know, they really haven't had a reason to. Like, they've been pretty bad. They had Andrea Bargnani.
C-Rat wrote something about that, I think, for...
Yes.
Was it True Hoop?
It was True Toronto. It was terrific. You guys should check it out.
Wonderful stuff about kind of the city and the country as a whole kind of finally getting behind Toronto after so many years of general apathy towards the team.
I'm reading Jonah Carey's book right now about the Montreal Expos.
I'm still looking to get it, but yes.
And it's interesting because I see a lot of parallels between the city, like Montreal embracing the Expos, and now Toronto, like, embracing the Raptors, just in terms of how, you know, the sport of the city is starting to change a little bit. So it's been really interesting to see, and it's really cool. You know, you always get excited for that fan base, like any fan base, to, you know, get back in the playoffs and to, you know, the start of something that could be, you know, potentially big.
Mm-hmm.
And then they didn't play so well.
Yeah, they came out, and we saw this from a lot of home teams, I think. They came out. I saw it in the Rockets in the first quarter. They were just going too fast. They were just playing. They were trying to do too much. I think, what was it, 11 first half turnovers for Toronto?
Yeah.
And it was clear that they were just going too hard and kind of too amped up, and they are a young team. I mean, this is obviously going to get, you know, we're going to get killed by the hot takes about experience versus youth. But to an extent, there's some truth to it. It's a young team in general, and that's kind of what makes them fun. But at the same time, I think they just were too amped up early, and they were never able to quite settle down completely. You know, they made a great run in the second half to get it back, but they just that first quarter was rough for sure.
Yeah, it was. And then DeRozan just didn't play well through any of the game. Terrence Ross wasn't that good. He hit like one or two like timely threes that brought him back in the game. Mm-hmm. Jonas played well.
Jonas looked great.
Amidst everything else, Jonas played very well. And it's exciting to see his development.
Especially because, you know, there were a lot of us that kind of picked Jonas to be our most improved. I think I did in the HP preview, and there were a few others that did as well. I was super hyped for him coming out of Summer League because he was so dominant there, and I was hoping he would translate that to the NBA floor, which I think it was a bit of an adjustment period for him. Still this year, kind of, you know, still kind of in a transition period for the team until Rudy left. Where they kind of finally figured out an identity. And to see him playing well and see him just gobbling up rebounds and going back up with the ball and doing his thing in the post, it's fun to see because you look at him as one of the future guys that you want as a post guy in the league. You have Anthony Davis, obviously, but you want some other young big guys to emerge, and he's kind of one you hang your hat on is hopefully he'll keep building.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I agree with all that. And it's really cool too, just to see a guy like that go up against KG, who loves picking on younger guys, but doesn't like picking on guys that are bigger than him, which is weird.
Hot takes. Shocker.
But I still think it's going to be a competitive series. You know, we really get wrapped up. I was talking with Matt about this. He's saying, why do people forget that like, there are seven games? Like, well, it happens every year. Like, this is the fun of the playoffs. We get wrapped up in everything that happens in game one, and then mm-hmm. we settle down after game two.
Right.
And that happens with teams, too, obviously.
Yeah. You want to get on some picks? I think we touched on most every series. Oh, except for Heat, Bobcats. It happened. There you go.
It happened, yeah.
Al Jefferson's hurt, so I'm pretty much writing the Bobcats off. I wanted to love the Bobcats. I did love the Bobcats, actually.
Stone Cold Steve Clifford's going to get them to play hard, but I still think, yeah, like, that hurts them.
At best, a gentleman's sweep at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
They can't score without Al Jefferson. They just can't, and he's walking around in a walking boot right now. He's day-to-day, but we've seen the plantar fasciitis. And for a guy who's, you know, he doesn't play with speed, but footwork is such a crucial part of his game in the post, being hobbled, I think, is just – it's just going to be too much for – he's still going to put up big double-doubles, I think, but I just – his efficiency, we saw it go down in the last three quarters of that game when he tried to play on it. It's a brutal blow.
It is.
Because I really thought, you know, the Bobcats could take a game or two from Miami without Jefferson healthy just because he's such a load. They could get one or two and make it kind of a fun series to watch because they are such a fun defensive team. And now it's just kind of a bummer. I feel bad for the Bobcats folks like Ben Swanson and all those guys that have watched this team since it came into the league for the second time. But I think they're on the right path.
Yeah.
I think that's the one thing you can look at.
For the first time
in a while, I feel confident that the Bobcats are on the up and up for good.
Right.
Not like, oh, this is a fluke year. Like the year they had like Gerald Wallace and Tyrus Thomas and all those guys, and I think Tyson Chandler was on that team that went to the playoffs that one year, but that series is a thing that's happening.
All right, now picks. Let's make this quick.
Pick them.
I go Thunder tonight in a much closer one throughout the game, not just with that comeback, and I have the Clippers tonight.
I'm gonna agree. I think we kind of went over why the Thunder just – I think they're just too much for Memphis. But I agree that I think Memphis is going to be better from the start. Better prepared, better from the start. But I just think Durant, Westbrook, and Ibaka are just too much. And I agree with the Clippers. I think it's a bounce back for them. It's hard to win two on the road in the playoffs in a row, especially as the underdog. So I think the Clippers come back. I think Blake Griffin – hot take, Blake Griffin plays more than 19 minutes.
Yeah, I think so. And that's
a – I know that's a bold prediction, but I'm saying that. And, so I think we agree on those two. And we can't make it a day without some Knicks news. Mike Woodson's gone.
I don't want to talk about this, Robbie.
I had to bring it up. It was such a happy podcast. We have to bring it down a little bit.
I don't want to talk about the Knicks. Mike Woodson got fired, which we all
expected.
Mike
Woodson's gone. It's gone. It kind of surprised me. It just kind of popped up in the middle of the day. I mean, we all kind of knew it was coming, but Mike Woodson's gone. Everyone's gone. I mean, they cleaned house. Herb Williams, he lasted a long time, but he's gone. And so slip the Knicks in on you.
And then Edelman, which
we'll
say this for another podcast, but it's sad to see Edelman go.
It is. He was one of the greats, one of the best coaches of the last 25 years for sure. He did great stuff with a lot of different teams. Yeah. So sad to see him go, and Ty Corbin also out in Utah.
Yeah.
So the coaching carousel begins.
Yes, it does. It keeps on turning.
It begins turning.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan White, and for Robbie Callen, we will see you guys next time.
Bye.